This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 380 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Linda B. And there are still spots for our, get ready for this little change here, Pod Abroad 2022 trip.
Oof, girl.
And we'd love to hear from you. If you have not joined our text community, we'd love for you to send us a hello at 916-659-5112.
And now, on to our read-along. Week, we will be continuing our A Breath of Snow and Ashes read along with chapter 65 entitled Moment of Declaration.
Jamie's out riding near Woolham's Mill with Major MacDonald and runs into some dudes. And just as they run into each other, the Major was, well, they're kind of standing. Jamie's standing around with the two horses. The Major is having some bowel troubles in the bushes. So Jamie is left to make small talk with, I think it's about five dudes, and they chat, and he says he's asked if he's on his way to Halifax, specifically because there's a meeting of the Committee of Correspondence there to select delegates for the Continental Congress. And he says, nah, he's just seeing a friend on his way home. But he goes, I may follow along after that to Halifax with absolutely no intention on doing that. And then some of the other people of the five are implying, you know, you may not be welcome after what you did in Cross Creek, after stopping that mob from tarring and feathering the printer. And then, of course, there's your Aunt Jocasta. She's a well-known loyalist. And they surprise him by saying that Duncan Innes is now a loyalist, going so far as to spending a lot of money printing, I think it's pamphlets or leaflets about people suggesting they, you know, repair relationships with the king.
Don't do it. Don't do it. In the words of TikTok, don't do it. I'm not going to do it, girl. I did it.
He did it. So they ask him point blank, what is your opinion? So a little bit of a side step. Remember all those times Diana has written and I've called out that Jamie or Claire will, in one of their intimate moments, ask, I don't mean like knocking boots, I mean like cuddle time or something at the end of the day. Or if they're in repose and just thinking about life, one of them will ask the other, is it time? And the answer up till now has been no, or not yet, or maybe soon. This, dear listener, is the moment. This is time. It is now time. Quote, well, he'd known it was coming, had now and then tried to imagine the circumstances of his declaration, in situations ranging from the vaingloriously heroic to the openly dangerous. But as usual in such matters, God's sense of humor trumped all imagination. And so he found himself taking that final step into irrevocable and public commitment to the rebel cause, just incidentally being required to ally himself with a deadly enemy in the process. Standing alone in a dusty road, with a uniformed officer of the crown squatting in the bushes directly behind him, breeches round his ankles. Quote, I am for liberty, he said, in a tone indicating mild astonishment that there could be any question regarding his position. Unquote. Yeah, anything with the Browns, I'd be very hesitant to involve myself with. It's not a good look. Not even a look. It's just not safe.
Well, I know that they have dispatched a majority of the Browns that were problematic. It doesn't mean that the remaining Browns are not equally problematic. So being at any kind of get-together where the man whose family raped and intended to kill your wife and be civil, that's a huge pill to swallow, and also a huge kudos and pat on the back for Jamie for being diplomatic enough to not murder all of these people in front of people.
It's a sticky wicket.
Sticky wicket.
So they're, of course, curious about him having just declared himself for liberty. They're curious about him being there with the red coat. And Jamie says, oh, that's a friend. That's just a friend. And Brown, well, Summer beat me to it, but I hadn't mentioned yet that Richard Brown was one of those five dudes. Brown clarifies, he's not a real soldier. He's retired on half pay. He works for the governor. And so the men believe that McDonald is the government? That too, I guess. They believe he's the governor's spy. And they're basically right. They're not wrong. So they're getting all riled up, wanting to attach Jamie and the major. So Jamie slaps the butts of his two horses, which makes them rear. He jumps off the horse. He slaps the two butts because he has his horse and, of course, the major's, which makes them rear and scares the other horses of the other five dudes. So he buys himself some time to distance himself from the five. And he runs into the woods, and Brown shoots at the major. Well, he thinks it's the major. I think it's the major's coat he has, his red coat, hanging on a tree or on a limb somewhere. And so when the major sees this, he ends up hitting Brown over the head with the tree branch that he had in his hand. So the major and Jamie run deeper into the woods. And not too long after that, the men are gone, as is the major's horse. But they left Gideon because he's a trusty arsehole of a horse. So they couldn't even, because of the horse's agitated state, they couldn't even walk him back. They couldn't raid him back. So they had to walk. Both of them walked Gideon back to the ridge. And Jamie realizes it was Diana's words, or it was text that I already read, but Jamie tells the major something along these lines too. But he realizes, like, with this irony, this kind of ironic humor, that actually he finally came to the point where he's been wondering about, worried about, maybe a little afraid about, I don't know. And it's come and it's gone by, and it wasn't in a blaze of glory, and it wasn't like over, you know, a beer. But the funny part is, other than that, just the circumstances of how it happened, is that he realizes that neither side believed him. The men didn't believe he was for liberty. And McDonald is like, I know you had to do that to save your life. It's all good.
But that's the thing. It's like, it's so difficult because he was forced basically by circumstance to be on the side of the crown for a while. And so now, and that was just to maintain the status quo and get the land and fill in the blanks here. But the bottom line is, he's always planned to make this transition. But this transition is not an easy one to make, because how do you convince the people you've been fighting against for how many years that you're no longer fighting against them, you're fighting with them? Nobody believes you. And then when you killed many members of the Brown community, because they, you know, kidnapped, raped your wife, whatever. But, you know, it's very difficult for him to try to navigate this new plane. It's awful. I can only see how bad this is, because the crown still kind of believes you're with them, but no one is ever going to believe you're not with the crown when you have been staunchly with the crown for so long. You are going to have to make a very aggressive and probably violent break.
Yes, you're going to have to do more than, it's going to be more than words.
Yeah, exactly.
Megan P. closes us out with, Jamie always finds himself in the most precarious situations, escorting a soldier when come upon by a Brown, a Quaker, and a rebel. It's almost the beginning of a joke. That is true, Megan. Jamie is always very diplomatic and careful with his words and with the sharing of his beliefs. These men are not men that he would normally converse about anything with, much less about a subject so serious. He figures out a way to respond to their queries without putting himself in an equally bad spot as a traitor to the crown. I think the tightrope he's been walking the last few books is really getting tough for him. And it didn't surprise me in the slightest that Brown and his cohorts would decide to do something physical in response to their disbelief of Jamie's words. Jamie, being much quicker and lighter on his feet than most men of his age and station, manages to get himself and McDonald away with an assist from McDonald holding a tree limb. Mm-hmm. I'm sure we will see that particular group of nasties again.
Sure. We're all sure. You don't get mentioned by name by Diana Gabaldone without a proper death or mention thereof.
Correct.
And that was chapter 65. Moving right along to chapter 66, entitled The Dark Rises, which sounds like a Batman reference, but it's really not.
We're back with Claire, because we're in first-person narration again. Bree bursts into her room, and accuses her of trying to die. And then she leaves. It was like, hey, Bree, nice to see you too. And then she leaves. Claire has been babied, understandably, because she's been ill, but she wants to get out. She has cabin fever, I'm guessing. But because she knows they wouldn't let her out, she has to sneak out. So she does. And she walks to the Christie cabin. Tom Christie is there, and he is, of course, surprised to see her because he's heard that she's been ill, so he doesn't expect to see her there.
I don't think he expected anyone to show up. Nobody shows up willingly to the Christie's house. Come on.
And he tells her she looks like a convict.
I love that she finally has a bonnet on, which is what he always wanted, right? He's like, why don't you cover your hair? It's shameful you don't cover your hair. And now she's covering it because she's literally ashamed of her hair because, you know, she was dying and they cut it.
So he's surprised to see, oh, I already said that. But he does invite her in to come and sit. So she's walked all this way from the Ridge house, the big house, to his home. And we don't have an exact like distance given, but it's long enough to, Diana did say that every 100 yards or so, she would have to, or maybe feet, but every 100 feet or yards, she would have to stop and get her breath again because she was had been so ill. She's in recovery, but had been so ill, but she's lost so much muscle tone, so much cardiovascular, that kind of thing.
She is in so much trouble from literally all sides. Like, she got up and left the house. So that means everyone inside of her house is pissed at her. They don't know it yet, but they're pissed at her. And then she's going to go to the Christie's and they're like, what are you doing here? I don't want everyone at your house to be pissed at me for you showing up for me. Like, there is literally, this is not a win-win situation for anyone. Nobody wins. Everyone's upset.
So the reason she left, besides, I think Dinah said this too, she absolutely wanted to get out. She needed to get out of her own house.
I think she wanted out, but she's also curious as to the origins of her illness. And she knows that the Christies were down too. So it's not just that she wanted to go take a stroll in the woods. It's that she wanted to feed the medical part of her brain while also feeding the muscles of her body that have been cooped up in a house with everyone telling her to not do anything for God knows how long.
So she walked all this way to not only get out of her house because she was, who knows, cabin fever. Mm-hmm. And but also because she wanted to check him out because she had heard that he was also sick, but he was the only one besides her. I think the only one in his household that was ill, but also the only one besides her who had similar symptoms or didn't have symptoms of the bloody flux. So this is probably my favorite scene with Tom, or between the two of these. He calls her a convict, unaccountable, and insane. It is. I love it.
Did you have like Les Miserables feelings, like Fantine feelings for her with all of her hair cut off?
No, I didn't think about it.
I'm surprised.
That's funny.
I did. Convicts and shaved heads. It's all about Les Mis.
She tells him that the two of them, meaning her and Tom, didn't have the same illness that everyone else had. And Tom is surprised at this. And so she wants to get to the bottom. She wanted to get to the bottom of this. She tries to explain the way infections are spread, but also that given this is how they spread, or this one spreads at least, the two of us, me and you, Tom, if I'm Claire, we haven't seen each other in weeks. So she's trying to imply, well, she's not trying to imply, she's expressing her, not yet concern, but her confusion or her medical, this is like,
curiosity. This,
exactly, her curiosity as to why were their symptoms and thus their illnesses so different from everyone else? If number one, and he's right, things happen in different areas, not only like in jails where they can spread quickly, but also far apart. Absolutely, she says, you're not wrong. She mentions malaria as one of those things that can be passed on by a mosquito, all these things. But her point to him, without going you know, she wasn't bringing her microscope with her. She wasn't trying to give him a huge lecture. She was just trying to say, this kind of thing is spread this way. The bloody flux is spread that way. And it makes sense that people who were living together or who had contact with each other would get the same thing. But she said, you and I, who had the same thing and no one else did, haven't seen each other at all in this time frame where we had, before we had gotten sick, before any incubation period, although I know she does not tell him that. But anyway, she's implying this is confusing.
It is, but they may not have contacted each other physically in that time period, but they probably had overlap of other people they contacted in that time period. And if it was waterborne,
nobody that they overlapped with had symptoms.
Right, but people carry malaria all the time and don't have symptoms.
But people don't pass malaria. It's mosquitoes. You can't get malaria from a person. So malaria was just an example.
I know, but there are people that are carriers of illnesses that do not have symptoms of illnesses. Just like right now with the
with COVID. Delta. Yes, we have asymptomatic carriers. Or asymptomatic people, I should say.
Which they're the worst. Can we just have that right now? Asymptomatic carriers are the worst. Because they don't know. They don't even know they're the worst, but they're the worst. They are the worst. It's not their fault, but if they don't have symptoms, they don't know they're sick, which means they're just going around and infecting other people. They're the worst. And they're in this book right now. We're reading.
They aren't, though, in this situation. And I'm not getting ahead of us.
Do we have a definitive answer yet?
No.
I don't think that we know.
But even she is saying she has not brought up the case of asymptomatic anything. So it's not part of the conversation yet. They can't exist. No one's doubting that. So her goal having been accomplished, meaning to see Tom, check on his health, and at least talk to him about this wonky, funky monkey situation with the we didn't see each other, but we had the same illness kind of thing. That hadn't been accomplished. Tom insists on walking her home, which is also funny.
Could you imagine if he hadn't, though?
Oh, I mean, she would have made it home, like, but it would have taken her twice as long.
You're not wrong. It would have taken her twice as long. But when she got there, everyone there would have been like, what an ass. How dare he not walk you home to make sure you're safe? Like, I think he it was a selfish thing he did to walk her home.
I think you can include
and
that in
selfish,
there. I don't think it was selfish only
selfish.
Selfish
sounds wrong, but I do not believe it was the wrong kind of selfish. Like, I'm not saying he was like, I'm only doing this for this, that, and the other. But I do believe that his need to continue to be a part of the community in a positive manner was like,
I don't think he did it because of community. I think I can acknowledge that it may very well have included, again, not evil selfishness, but him wanting to do something so he didn't get yelled at, whatever. Right. Like I can envision that.
It was self-preservation, I think is the term I'm looking for.
Potentially, but I see it more as, well, honestly, I see it more as exactly what Diana tells it was. The fact that he got to see her get a tongue lashing. And he loved it. So Tom walks her home. And once she's there, everyone scolds her and she's put back into bed. And I love this quote. The most annoying aspect of the whole situation was Thomas Christie standing at the foot of the stairs with a mug of beer in his hand, watching as I was let off and wearing the only grin I had ever seen on his hairy face. Unquote.
So he also wanted to watch her get in trouble. So, I mean, that was also selfish.
selfishly wanting to see her, like, whip with a wet noodle? Absolutely.
Like reprimanded? Absolutely. There is a type of, what is it, Schadenfreude? Is that Schadenfreude? Or you enjoy the misery of others?
Schadenfreude is taking
joy in other people's shame.
In having, I wouldn't say shame, but it's having
Schaden
joy.
Is?
Schaden is, it might be shame, like the literal.
Like, Shada, that's too bad. That's a shame.
But it's basically taking joy in other people's misfortune. That's what it is.
Yeah. Pleasure derived from someone's
misfortune. But this is not misfortune. You might call
this. But it is, though.
You might call it Schadenfreude light or jokey Schadenfreude. But it's not her misfortune. It's like if she was going to be whipped and beaten when she got home, that's Schadenfreude.
I mean, he doesn't know that. And if Jamie hadn't already promised not to, he would have. He said, I'm tempted to spank you.
Yeah, but he wouldn't have done as much as he had done back in Outlander because her body wouldn't stand it. She was bones. I wouldn't say Schadenfreude, but along those lines, him taking pleasure in her embarrassment and not like not mortification, right? She's not mortified, but her, in her embarrassment, in her like, oh my gosh, I snuck out of here successfully, but I have to come walking up the front walk.
I think he gets so much from it. He gets the joy of watching her get in trouble. One, he gets the joy of not being, why didn't you walk her home? Like the community of shaming him for not helping her get home. So as a, not being a gentleman. So he gets the joy of not having that being an issue. Like, I think it's a win-win for Tom Christie. 100%.
If not, and hold on, you forgot the most important part. They gave him beer.
So you're saying he came for the beer?
No. I said you're leaving it out. No. What does he get out of this? That's what you said. It's a few things. You said there's helping her, there's not being tongue-lashed, whatever, and there's beer and maybe food. We weren't even told about the food. Who knows? And then Jamie, oh, that's where I got the term because I have it right on the next line. So then he sticks around for who knows how long. That's all we see of him or hear of him. Jamie's upstairs with her and he gives her a tongue-lashing, undresses her, puts her in bed. He reminds her of the Abbey in France where she had taken care of him as a young, stubborn young man. And she goes, yeah, but I also remember that stubborn young man getting out of bed naked in the middle of the afternoon, walking outside in the snow. And he's like, yeah, I wasn't meant to have sense back then, but whatever.
Good God. He's like, I was only 20. Was it 4 and 20? Is that what he said? I was only 24. I know lots of idiot 24-year-olds. They're just doing their best.
Yeah. So that night, he's in his, apparently, for now, usual place of a pallet on the floor next to the bed. So he's not, you know, going to turn over and like crush her or hurt her. And so she has plenty of room while she's recuperating. And she says, she tells Jamie she needs him and she needs him. So ... this made me laugh. Quote, I felt a brief pang at the thought that the hair on my private, I wrote privacy. On my privates. Private I had a parts. Brief pang at the thought that the hair in my privates was longer than that on my head. Unquote. So that.
So if anyone was wondering how long Claire's hair is.
Exactly. It is not. It actually. It's not going to be a buzz cut like a military buzz cut because they didn't have those tools. But it's not going to be much longer.
But it's long enough to curl because she mentions that she has like a tiny curly.
Brillo pad or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Those are my words, but yeah, something like that. That's so this is the best, you know, check your privates and what, however long that average length of, they is that, pluck 10
is that
hairs.
A private goal? Make sure your privates are shorter than the hair on your head. Is that,
oh
like,
no, I'm just saying if you want an approximate measure of her hair on her head, because people talk about it. Oh, it wasn't that short. Oh, she was bald. No, she was not bald. Diana never says she was bald. She says she had like powder puff on her head. It was like not very long, but this is definitive. Check the average length of 10 hairs of your pubesticles. And
don't
that,
tell them to do that. Stop it. I don't like where this is going.
My point is that length was longer than the hair on her head.
Well, nah. No, she said there's no guarantee that it was longer than the hair on her head. She just implied that she was concerned that it was. So the hair on her head could have been shorter.
That's what I'm saying. Whatever the average length of a pubesticle is, yeah, she thought
Can't
it was
stop it. That's
shorter.
The worst. Now I'm imagining a popsicle with hair in it. Stop
oh,
it.
Oh, nasty.
Gross. You Good said Lord. It.
Yeah, but I didn't go to food.
You're fired.
I didn't go to food.
You said pubesicle. How do I not go
no,
to food
no, no, no.
with pubesicle?
Summer, I did not say pubesicle. I said pubesticle.
I promise it sounded like pubesicle.
I understand that you heard that, but I very carefully say the ST in there each time. So but anywhoozle, so that's how that chapter ends.
Please don't put any pubic hairs on my popsicles. That sounds nasty. And that was chapter 66. Moving right along to chapter 67, entitled The Last Laugh.
Jamie is with a group of Cherokee. Standing Bear is one of the men there, and he's been given an old musket. In fact, 5 of the men there had gotten muskets from Bird. And Bird still has 25 left to give, either give out, I'm sure he's going to keep at least one of them, but to give out or to be accounted for, whoever he wants to give them to. So this is the end. I think it was in book 5. I don't think it was in book 6. And I'm pretty sure it was not in book 4, but I think it was in book 5 where he, when he becomes, or when he is the agent of the crown, and he meets with at least this group of Cherokee. And in order to do whatever, you know, he wanted them to do, or they wanted him to do,
part of the negotiation.
Yes, the negotiation was, I think, 30 muskets. And this, we know it all happened before the breakup of Lizzie and Manfred, right? Because the whole one part of the deal was he was going to go to Rob McGillivray, Manfred's father, to get many of them. I don't know how many, not all of them, but a chunk of them. And after they were shunned from Uta et Familia, he had to go find some more. So I'm just saying that's a marker, an event marker of where we know what him making the deal with Bird happened before that point. So Bird has 25 left. He's going to divvy them out, keep them for himself, whatever he's going to do. But yes, as Summer said, that deal, that negotiation, like that's done. That's been fulfilled. Hiram Crombie's also along for the ride because he wants to teach and preach to the natives about Christianity. Quote, "He has come to offer his friendship and to tell you stories of the Christ," unquote. I think that was Jamie who said that.
With or against your will.
So it was autumn, we learn, and harvest is on, full on. And so they're celebratory. I mean, I don't know how much of a feast compared to this feast, but they, whenever Jamie visits them, they always have like, at least a type of meal, type of feast, whether it's welcoming or to, you know, show good faith, negotiations, whatever it is. That's hospitality, right? So there's always something going on.
I had such like a, I don't know, like a feeling about the land and nature listening to this chapter. For whatever reason, this is not the first time I've been made aware of this fact. I know this fact. This fact is a fact that autumn is when we harvest, and the harvest happens before the winter, and winter is when there's nothing growing. And so the big harvest we have in winter is what we have to see us through over the winter to get us through to the following spring and summer. But for whatever reason, it like resonated with me more deeply, maybe because I have a dying garden in my backyard and I was forced to make salsa today because my tomatoes are all ripening at the same time. But I was struck by the simplicity of nature and how perfect it is, and how it made the plants for all of us if we just follow through. And I don't know, I've never had that kind of a stark connection with an autumnal harvest in a book before, but knowing they're about to go into the time of year when there is nothing new to harvest and you are stuck mostly in your house and you don't do anything, whereas most of us are stuck in our houses and still teleworking, and we will for the foreseen until this pandemic stops. But I don't know. I had a moment, y'all.
So as I said, it's autumn, it's harvesty, and they're eating really well. Young Ian is there, of course. He's staying near Hiram to help him out with his Cherokee. Hiram, we hear several times in the chapter that Hiram's actually doing pretty well, especially on the bits of Cherokee that he memorized. But as far as having conversation, he's still at the point, as if you've ever learned a language, this is very common. Most, if not all, most, especially adult learners, when you're learning a language or you're trying to have, say, a conversation especially, you, until you get to a certain level of fluency, you are stuck necessarily directly translating everything you hear, because there's no frame of reference. You don't know idioms or slang or, you know, figures of speech yet. So it is, you're grasping for literally any word you know. And even if you know them, you are translating them word by word, or, you know, word for word. And so that's the state at which, or the, in his language learning process, that's where Hiram still is. And that's what Diana was saying. So Ian was staying near him to help him out. And he was, Jamie, as I said, was ending this arrangement with Bird, and he had done his best by him. It was not, as far as Jamie was concerned, a melancholy leave-taking, but a sense of completion. And along with the last, two chapters ago, 65, where Jamie comes upon, Jamie tries to declare himself for liberty, but no one believes him. In the same vein, even though they don't believe him, he's done it. Like, the time is now, as I said, as Diana has said, like, or as Jamie realized, this is that time. We're there now. they don't believe me, but I've done the first step. And along with that, knowing that there's no going back now, it makes perfect sense. The timing is really good. I mean, again, none of this is wonderful, but the timing is good that his official relationship, or his official duties, I guess, as the Indian agent for the king, is now literally complete. He's not quitting early. He's not saying, look, I got to peace out. He literally is finishing the arrangement he took on. And he would never again play the role of the agent of an agent to the king. So it's kind of, this sense of completion dovetails nicely with chapter 65. Even though no one believed him, Jamie actually declared himself. But that dovetails nicely with this very natural ending of his relationship, his duties as the king's agent, more frequent, I guess, visits with Bird. He may see Bird again, but it will never be in that same capacity.
Yeah, he's like, I'm done being your go-between.
Yeah, and he actually said, and I didn't write this down, but I remember this, he actually felt, again, not peace necessarily, because he knows that shiz is coming down the road, a different kind of shiz. He's exchanging one shiz for another shiz. It's not really great, but he knows he has to do this coming shiz because that's the right side of history. But it's not peace necessarily, but if I'm not mistaken, what we read or what I remember reading was that it was he could finally like be a part of like an audience. He could be there and enjoy the meal. Like he did not have to worry.
He could let the subterfuge go. He could just be.
He could just be a friend. He could just be someone there sitting at the table or around the fire pit or wherever they're eating.
He could be honest, and there was just no more subterfuge. He didn't have to pretend or, you know, try to figure out how to limit
or be in charge
the damage he's doing. Yes. You know what I mean? It's like knowing that in just a few years, what he's trying to forge for friendships right now are no longer going to be the friendships he wants to have forged. Trying to negotiate that particular prickly path that's got to be exhausting. I would be totally relieved to be done with the subterfuge.
Although I don't know how much subterfuge it was, because he was an Indian agent. That was not subterfuge. He was happy actually to, given what he had heard from Claire, Brianna, and Roger, he was not upset that he was trying to arm some of the Cherokee. So I don't think there was subterfuge. I don't know that his relationship with Bird or his role as an Indian agent was subterfuge. He did it. He didn't hide it. But now
the subterfuge was pretending to be on the side of the crown when he was just being part of the crown until it was no longer convenient to be part of the crown.
I understand what you're saying, but I don't. What I'm saying is he didn't fake being an Indian agent. He did his role well. I think he did.
No.
He was much better. Remember, the reason he did it was because if he hadn't, the Browns would have, right? So he absolutely, so there was no subterfuge in that. He absolutely was like, look, I don't want to do this, but it's better me. I'm a better person to do this than the Browns, right? Because they would get too much power. So absolutely.
They get rapey.
Oh, well, they're a lot.
They get rapey when they get powerful.
But none of the Browns raped Claire. So that's not really an accurate statement.
Letting it happen in your presence is just as bad.
I didn't say they were good people, but they did not do
none of the remaining Browns contributed to her rape. You are not wrong there.
Well, that part's over with. But yes, I think everyone can agree that it was better to have Jamie than a Brown. I guess what I disagree with is, okay, subterfuge in the form of, once they got like back after Voyager, right? Like starting in book four, when they got to North Carolina, they got their land, they got to the ridge. Like there has been subterfuge. Well, his family knows he's Catholic. The people on the ridge knows he's Catholic. That's not, he can't and doesn't hide it from them. But the wider world, the governor agrees to keep it hidden because he wouldn't have been able to get that land grant, right? So there's subterfuge there, right? In going along with the governor. I'm not blaming him. I'm just saying there's some subterfuge. He never lied, but I guess that's not true. He had to lie.
Lying is not the definition of not having subterfuge.
I understand that. I'm going through different things that one might consider subterfuge. Okay. So one subterfuge absolutely would be, and this never gets corrected, and I'm not upset about it. One subterfuge, at least from the time in book four when he gets the land grant until up till now even, is that Catholics could not own that land. So even though he had it, he went along. And again, no one's getting after Jamie for this, right? He was able to get a place and build a home and have his family and all that. So that's not a bad thing. But I can agree with you. What I'm trying to find is ways where there was subterfuge. And subterfuge doesn't necessarily, I mean, this is going to sound really weird. I don't think subterfuge necessarily has to be a bad thing. It sounds very bad, right? If you said, oh, it was full of subterfuge, like, oh, he was a liar. He was a spider.
You're right.
Spider.
Well, I mean, but the
spider?
At the
did
crux
I just say
of,
spider?
You did.
Oh, my
at
God.
At the crux of a subterfuge is a lie.
Correct.
Now,
dishonesty,
some lies
yes.
are clearly worse than others. However, at the root of it, they are 100% lies.
I don't think that people on the ridge, I mean, maybe Tom Christie knew this or would have been aware of it. And I'm not knocking anybody, but I don't know that all those settlers, immigrants from Scotland who were, you know, water people, right? Fishermen who had to now come here, and they absolutely knew Jamie was Catholic, but I don't know how many of them, they barely spoke English. I don't know how many of those people, for example, would have known there was a law that said Catholics couldn't own land.
Yeah, I mean, you don't know till you know. That's the nature of the frontier, isn't it? You only know what you know when you know it.
And it's not about them being stupid. It's about them being simple people and they're not lawyers.
Uninformed.
They don't have an opportunity. And quite frankly, they don't need to have that knowledge. It's not anything you would expect them to have. So
I mean,
that's open subterfuge right there. Jamie having his land is open subterfuge until or unless that law is changed. And it hasn't been changed yet, to the best of my knowledge. I don't mean today. I mean, as of this point in the book. So that's one count of open subterfuge. Him being an Indian agent is not subterfuge in that he's not an Indian agent.
No, but it is in the fact that he doesn't believe in what he's touting to them, and he is actively trying to subvert them.
But he's not trying the British, yes, but he's not trying to subvert the Cherokee.
No, but I think deep down he's hoping they don't stay with the crown. But right now what he's doing is arming them on behalf of the crown.
Correct.
Which is making them beholden to the crown because of the weapons. That's it.
Well, I think it's elsewhere. It's definitely not in this chapter, but I think it's elsewhere that it's whoever was, I don't even know what the Browns would have done, probably would have killed them all. But if Jamie or someone like Jamie, right, were this Indian agent, which he was, my guess, okay, we know what Jamie did, right? He did the bidding. He made the contacts. He made the plans. He agreed to get the muskets. He went about getting them and paying for or bartering for them. And then he delivered them. So he literally 100% with that from his own pocket. Like, he had to do it all, literally do it all. Who knows if another person, again, not a Brown, would have done the same thing. I think possibly, but you're right. The reason Jamie or someone else would have armed them was because that was what his role would have been, right? As an Indian agent, the British or the governor, whomever, wanted him to offer or get arms to the Indians in the hopes that they would fight on the side of the British, right? Because the British were trying to count on all that they could. And Jamie absolutely went along with that. But yeah, I could see subterfuge in that he didn't do it for the good of the British. He did it in hopes that when push came to shove, okay, these people actually have at least, they don't have a chance to get an army, but a small number of them, if they can get out of Dodge, they may have a chance at survival.
Well, the larger question is whether or not they will trust him enough to listen to him when he switches sides and he says, do not follow these people anymore. Exactly. So it's like, It's beginning communications with people under false pretenses. That's it. It's subterfuge. I'm not saying it's malevolent. I'm just saying that it's 100% what he's doing. He's trying to do something that he doesn't believe in.
He doesn't want to help the British. He does believe in arming the Cherokee. If he had a moral problem with that, he wouldn't have done it.
He had a little bit of one.
He did.
Remember, he was like, I don't really want to give you good guns. I'm okay with giving you some guns.
But I don't know if that was a moral thing. I think that was a money thing.
I don't think it was a money thing. It felt more like a they may be on the other end of that musket from me.
Got
in
it.
Six
oh, so
months,
if I have to give them stuff,
and I'm not interested. Got yeah, it. I'm not giving them
okay,
the bestest
then I
of
can,
the bestest.
I can see that. I can see that. So, as in, although we only get one really great.
This is the longest conversation we've had about a 4-page chapter, I think, ever.
So, although we've had great, well, one really well-known scene, and I guess we lost it, or maybe it happened. I don't remember when the scene, when was the scene where Jamie and young Ian were visiting the Cherokee and at least two women went to Jamie's bed?
All the sexy times? That happened at least twice in this book, but it was closer to the beginning.
No, there was one scene where Ian is blowing a gasket with laughter. It was the first time they had sent Jamie.
That may have been the last book, to be honest.
Okay. So,
but I can't say that for sure because we've been reading this book for so long.
For so long. True. So, it doesn't matter where it's at. I'm just wondering. I am not bitching about it. I'm just wondering aloud because I know we've talked about it and I don't know if we're like done, gone, gone. I know they brought books, some of book six into season five. We know this. I'm hoping that if the scene I'm just referring to was actually in book five, I wonder, you know what? Actually, this is a wider question. Do you agree with me if I say that they don't need, production does not need the Indian agent storyline?
They probably don't. I mean, I don't, I just say that to say that I don't believe that in the books that I've read since, circle back to it yet. So I don't know if that is a book 10, book 9, book we haven't read yet thing that's about to come to pass. But as it stands right now, I do not believe that it is something that makes a meaningful appearance in the books we currently have. Reappearance, I should say.
The reason I went on that slight tangent was because there is conversation before bedtime in this chapter. Jamie tells Bird that Jamie didn't want it either, but Jamie tells Bird, he warns him about Hiram. He's like, you know, Hiram has a wife and he would not welcome a woman into his bed. But, and I did not go look her up. So I don't know who this person is. I don't know if it's Bird's wife or someone else higher up, but there is a woman, a female Cherokee woman who's named Penstemon, I believe. And so anyway, Jamie's telling Bird, look, Hiram has a wife. He wouldn't welcome this. I'm gonna tell you up front, best not do this. And Penstemon says, no worries. He stinks. No one wants a child from him.
Our ladies don't want to deal with him.
No.
You, however, my sir.
Exactly.
I'll send all the women to your cabin because we'd love to get a little redheaded
jeans.
Changeling.
Everyone enjoys themselves that evening. From everything we're told, the rest of the chapter, everyone enjoyed themselves. They had a good last night out, I guess. And the chapter ends with a letter from Jamie to John Stewart.
Do you find it crazy how close and yet how far away we are from the Continental Congress?
No. I mean, yes, it is. Like, it's right there, but it's also like
it's
500
imminent.
Chapters away.
Exactly. It's so imminent, but it's like, bleh, don't expect it anytime soon.
This letter does a few things. It does its purpose. It fits in nicely with two chapters ago. It follows up Jamie's verbal stance declaration, and it ends apart. So it's really great placement by Diana. So it has those three factors and or three things that I noticed. So this letter from Jamie to John Stewart, what is this and what does it say? Jamie officially resigns as Indian agent. And this letter is signed November 1st, 1774.
We're so close. We're so close to the 76. Everyone get comfortable. It's going to be a while. And that was chapter 67. Join us next time and we will be continuing our Breath of Snow and Ashes read along and starting part 9 entitled The Bones of Time. We'll be doing chapter 68 entitled Savages and chapter 69 entitled A Stampede of Beavers. And we're not talking about lady bits, I don't think. I hope not. That'd be weird if it was after I just said it wasn't.
Again, a special thanks to co-producer Linda B. To find out more about how you can support us on Patreon and maybe even become a co-producer, visit outlanderpod.com/Patreon.
And if you want to join us to continue the conversation, you can go to www.outlanderpod.com/group and join our Facebook group where we continue talking about Outlander even when we're not podcasting. And if you're interested in any Outlander Pod branded merchandise, you can go to our shop at www.outlanderpod.com/shop.
If you haven't joined our text community, we'd still love you to be part of it. It's free, as I said. You can simply text hello to 916-659-5112. And thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.